This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
What that empathy did was then create a sort of like set the table for a negotiation that allowed us to come up with a settlement agreement that equally valued the rights of nature, indigenous peoples, and business.
While diverting the flow of a river is a practice that people have been engaging in for about 5,000 years, dams are far from harmless. Like many human inventions, dams have been known to perpetuate economic hierarchies, rob communities of essential resources, and wreak havoc on ecosystems. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to Amy Bowers Cordalis, an attorney who has a new book out, The Water Remembers, My Indigenous Family's Fight to Save a River and a Way of Life. It tells the story of her legal crusade to tear down the Klamath River Dam and help restore the river to its natural state. A UN champion of the Earth Laureate, Cordalis recounts the history of the construction of four dams at the headwaters of the Klamath, a move that constricted the river's flow, killed hundreds of thousands of salmon, and choked the lifeblood of the Yurok Nation in Northern California. She led the appeal that resulted in the decommissioning of the structures, ultimately ensuring the removal of the dams in 2024, and marking the largest successful dam removal project in world history. Join us to hear the story of a true climate activist and to better understand what it took to actuate change. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Amy Bowers Cordalis. Her new book is entitled The Water Remembers, My Indigenous Family's Fight to Save a River and a Way of Life. Amy, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Guinakoi, Ayakui, thank you for having me.
So why don't you first explain the narrative that you carve out here and the template that you use?
Well, thank you. So The Water Remember is a memoir about my family's intergenerational struggle and fight to save the Klamath River and our Yurok way of life. I'm a member of the Yurok tribe of Northern California. And every generation of my family since the colonizers arrived in the mid-1800s has fought to save ourselves, save our access to our lands, our waters, and to preserve the species that our life depends upon. And in the book, I tried to tell the story about very legal things, failed treaties, Supreme Court cases, the fish wars. And I think what's great about the book is it ends with Klamath Dam removal, which is the largest dam removal, the largest river restoration project in history. And so the narrative is about the family struggles through the generations and how Klamath Dam removal really is this turning point in my family's history and really in the world where we are beginning to go back to balance, to living in balance with the natural world, how my ancestors did pre-colonization.
So what I meant also by the narrative was that you use this authentic Yurok style and tone, that the storytelling format is not what a reader might be used to.
Exactly. So it's my invitation to the reader to join me on the banks of the Klamath River in my family's fish camp after a long day of fishing. And maybe we still have a net in the river and, you know, the river's rolling by and we've got a campfire. And I hope that the book places the readers there with me on the river bar and I'll tell them a story. And I wrote the book in the way that I heard the stories. You know, I'm a lawyer. And so I've written about, you know, Yurok cases, other federal Indian law cases. I didn't want to write that kind of a book. I wanted to write a book that really just pulled people into Yurok culture and the Yurok experience over the last 150 or so years, 170 or so years, really, and made them feel like they're one of us. And in the end, I hope that the overall message of the good work that we've been able to do on the Klamath will make people feel hopeful for the future.
Let's take a step back and explain the conundrum that environmentalists face when trying to undam a dam, because these were hydroelectric power plants. This is clean energy. So somebody who's an environmentalist could be like, well, this is better than coal, right? So give it some context and some history, and then we'll get up to speed later in the discussion.
Context is everything, especially when you're thinking about dams. So on the Klamath, the entire Klamath Basin, which is a large basin, it is over 400 river miles. It straddles or Southern Oregon and Northern California. It is Indian country throughout to this day. Also, historically, the Klamath had the third largest salmon runs in the whole lower continental US. So it is this massive, beautiful, powerful basin. And it has a bunch of different kinds of ecosystems between, redwoods are right there, rivers, high country, which is the mountains, the Klamath Siskiyou Mountains. And then as you get into Oregon, there's the Upper Klamath Lake. There used to be a lake, wetlands. I mean, it's just this remarkable place. It's one of the most biodiverse places in the world. But then through colonization, four dams were built in the middle of the river without fish ladders. And so they were built between 1911 and the last one was built in 1964, and they completely blocked any kind of salmon passage. And that is extremely harmful to salmon because they can't get to their historical spawning grounds.
Beyond the salmon, what was the impetus of these four dam projects from 1911 to 1964?
The purposes of them were twofold. It was flood control at the time, and then also power production. But they produce, I should say, I'm still adjusting to this past tense language because the dams just came out last October or August. But so they produced a minimal amount of power, right? So by the end of their lifespan, it was something like under 2% of PacifiCorp, who owned the dams, their power portfolio came from the Klamath dams, and that power could easily be replaced by other sources.
Clean sources.
Clean sources. Yeah. But I also, to your point about clean energy, so the Klamath dams had about 2,000 acres of reservoirs behind them because there were four dams, and behind each dam, there was a reservoir. And at the top of the Klamath Basin, there is a very large federal reclamation project that is agricultural lands, and they put agricultural chemicals on the land, and those lands are former wetlands. And so those chemicals go through the wetlands and then back into the river system and would pool behind the reservoirs. And so every year you would get extremely polluted water. There would be toxic blue-green algae blooms every year, and also methane. An extreme amount of methane produced. And so even though the power was hydropower, it wasn't clean because you had this methane production coming from the reservoirs. Also, I don't think that any energy is clean if it's harming and killing an ecosystem and tribal rights and ways of life. I mean, that's not clean energy.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Amy Bowers Cordalis. She's a lawyer, and her new book is entitled The Water Remembers. So, Amy, we're talking about this Klamath River project. You're giving us some background on it. So, 1964 was the last damming of the river. What happened between 1964 and 2024 when the dam was removed?
Gradually, the river just got sicker and sicker. So, the Klamath River is fierce and mighty, as are all of the species that it supports. But even the river has its breaking point. And by 2002, the legacy impacts of the colonization of the river through damming and then the development of the hydroelectric project came to a tragic moment. In 2002, there was the largest fish kill in American history on the Lower Klamath River within the Yurok Reservation, where around 70,000 adult salmon died due to a fish disease called ick, which spreads in really bad river conditions. So that year in 2002, there was a drought. And as a political move by the Bush-Cheney administration, Vice President Cheney ordered an extreme amount of water to be diverted from the river to support agricultural diversions. And the result was the lowest water levels in recorded history on the lower part of the river at the same exact time as a very healthy, abundant adult Chinook salmon run returned to the Klamath River. And tragedy struck. I was working for tribal fisheries then, and I was on the river every single day that summer. I remember when the fish started dying, and the fish kill lasted for a couple weeks, and it was one of the most awful moments of my life because there was nothing you could do to stop it. And so we just felt so helpless and so marginalized and like nobody cared. And my great grandmother, who had passed away, 20 years earlier, came to me and really told me I had to fight and I had to become a lawyer to try to protect my tribe and my river and my salmon from ever experiencing anything like that again. And so that launched me into law school and my career path, and it launched many others too. I mean, the fish did not die in vain. The fish kill really was the canary in the coal mine alerting the humans that everything was really out of balance. And if we didn't change the way we managed the Klamath River, it was going to die and we were going to lose our fish and maybe even have the whole river collapse. And so it was a really remarkable moment for me and for many others, and it changed lives for sure.
So let's pick it up from 2002 then, after this fish kill, if you can kind of summarize the legal struggle from its genesis.
Yeah, so when the dams were built, I don't think that I know Yurok was not consulted. We weren't told about what was happening. It was just done. The project started in the early, 1911, I mean 1905 is when there were plans, and no, so Yurok people, Yurok rights were not considered at all. And that was again around in the early 1900s, the federal and state governments were just finishing up the business of genocide toward Native people. So by the end of about like 1910, 90% of California's indigenous population had been slaughtered by the state of California and by settlers, and the federal government was right there with them trying to take away Indian land and rights, taking our children. And that happened to my great grandmother. She was sent to boarding school. They also prohibited our religion, and that's in the book as well. And so when these dams were built, we weren't even on the radar. And yet, down at the mouth of the river, my family continued our struggle. And so in 1933, the state of California adopted a law that prohibited all Yurok people from fishing. And that was like making breathing illegal. And so the family fought back, and it took 40 years. And my great uncle Ray, and this is all in the book, was arrested 20 times. But his Supreme Court case affirmed that the Yurok Reservation was still Indian country on the lower part of the Klamath River, and that we still had sovereignty, we still had fishing rights, we still had water rights, that land was still ours. And that decision came down in 1973. And that really laid the legal foundation for what became the legal fight to remove the dams, almost 50 years later. In the meantime, there was salmon wars, where after we won the Supreme Court case, the federal government came in and put a full moratorium on all Yurok fishing, which was atrocious, right? And we fought back.
What year was the Supreme Court case? Sorry.
1973, and that affirmed, the reservation, our fishing rights, our water rights, that the land was still ours. And it, that should have been the end of it. Like, we should have been able to continue our fishing-based way of life, our culture, express our sovereignty, but it wasn't. Then, in response to the decision, and it took a couple of years, but in 1978, the federal government put a moratorium on all Yurok fishing and sent a full federal marshal team in riot gear with gigantic jet boats to enforce the moratorium. And again, my family and other Yurok people went out to the river and fished, because that was their way of life, and they knew they had their Indian rights. And all of this was illegal according to federal law. And if you were going to empower the tribes' supreme rights, like our rights that were based in federal law, which are the supreme law of the land under the US Constitution, it was all illegal. And we knew that. And so we kept fighting. And so really, though, what happened was that after, so eventually the federal government, and this is a true story, just agreed. Like, they realized, oh, they actually have a federally reserved fishing right, and we can't just completely kick them off the river like that. And there's this powerful protest where my grandmother and my great grandma were out in the boat on the river, and my great grandma sings this deeply powerful Yurok song that calls in help from the creator, from the birds, and it scares the heck out of these federal marshals. And you have to read the book to get the whole story. But it literally kicked those guys off the river, and they never came back. They never came back. And so and this was all kind of coming together around 1979, 1980. And so by then, we had really secured our legal rights to be on the land, to be on the water, to fish, and to live how we always had. And then that's when the salmon started declining. That's when we started seeing all of the legacy impacts of the development of the dams, of the reclamation project really hitting home, that then accumulated with the fish kill. And then that, launched us into the Undam the Klamath movement.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Amy Bowers Cordalis. Her book is called The Water Remembers: My Indigenous Family's Fight to Save a River and a Way of Life. So, Amy, what were the shots across the bow or the real accelerators of you and your colleagues' case to dismantle the dams? If you could point to one or two lightning rod moments, what were they?
Yeah, and great question. So, after the fish kill, there was a grassroots movement to undam the Klamath. And it started with the indigenous peoples of the Klamath Basin. And it was Yurok, Karuk, Hoopa, Klamath tribes, Shasta nations. Like, it was a coalition of Indian people that went and protested at the dam owners, and it changed a couple times, but eventually got to Berkshire Hathaway, PacifiCorp, which are all owned by one of the world's richest men, Warren Buffett, and they would protest these meetings. And then I think the sort of good medicine came into play. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, license to operate the Klamath Dams expired in 2006. And so in 2004, FERC initiated a relicensing proceeding, which gave the Yurok tribe and eventually others the opportunity to request dam removal. And this was huge because we had a regulatory pathway to dam removal. When we first started this initiative, people didn't think dam removal was possible. The state of California, for example, didn't even participate until way down the road. Oregon hardly participated. PacifiCorps asked for the dams to be relicensed consistent with the status quo. So, no fish passage, no updates for environmental laws that had been passed in the past 50 years.
And what was the estimated cost of dismantling these dams?
We didn't know at that point when we first started. So, but that was one of the key things about the regulatory process was that through this hearing, there was a hearing to relicense the dams. And during the hearing, we argued that the tribe's rights established in my family's Supreme Court case, Mass versus Arnett, and then the subsequent precedent that developed since then, that's, was clear that we had federally reserved fishing and water rights that were basically being destroyed by these dams. We coupled those with the Federal Power Act and with several other environmental laws. And teamed up with NGOs to make these really strong arguments. Us, along with the Karuk tribes, the NGOs, made really strong arguments based on the tribes' reserved fishing water rights, these federal laws, environmental laws, to make the case that these dams were no longer in the public interest because they were harming salmon runs and indigenous rights. And we won on almost every account. And what that led to was basically a posturing where if FERC was going to relicense the dams, they had to include fish prescriptions, which would have been installing fish ladders. So if PacifiCorps wanted to relicense the dams, they would have had to install fish ladders. And here's where the economics comes in. So we did an economic analysis, and it was cheaper to remove the dams than it was to install the fish ladders. And so that was our aha moment. And that was a major turning point in the whole thing because all of the sudden, it was cheaper to remove dams. That meant that PacifiCorps had an interest in removing the dams, and that interest was also ours. And so we pressed pause on the hearing and started settlement negotiations that led to a $515 million settlement agreement to remove the Klamath Dams.
So, can you break down the numbers of what it meant to break down this dam, Amy, in terms of the economics of it?
Yeah, the magnitude is hard to even digest. It is the world's largest river restoration project. So we removed four dams from the Middle Klamath River, and in that we removed over 411 feet of dam. And what's really cool is that we were able to remove a lot of that material, and much of it was actually earthen dam, especially from the first dam, and put it back to where they had extracted the earth and the dirt. So we rebuilt the ecosystem in that way. We opened up over 400 miles of spawning habitat behind the dams. And then also in the former reservoir areas, we have planted over 19 billion native seeds. And so we are literally renewing the world in that area by rebuilding ecosystems with first foods like acorns and willows that are used for basket making. It's really remarkable.
So, what are the big takeaways for you from an environmental standpoint and from an indigenous people's standpoint in terms of this case? What template have you created that could be replicated elsewhere, Amy?
What we did on the Klamath is scalable. It is a scalable climate crisis solution model. And that's one of the things that makes me so excited. So through coalition building and empowering and uplifting the indigenous rights and coupling those rights with other environmental laws, with energy laws, that helped really made it so that we had a very strong coalition of people working together, both on the legal strategy, but also on the politics side of things. And who developed important, deep relationships with one another, power executives and tribal leaderships. And what that did was create a willingness to work together and also an understanding of how everybody's interactions with the basins impacted everybody's way of life. And that led to empathy. And what that empathy did was then create a sort of like set the table for a negotiation that allowed us to come up with a settlement agreement that equally valued the rights of nature, indigenous peoples, and business. Combine these legal rights so that you're creating leverage for change, but also develop important relationships where you're understanding different ways of life so that you can develop empathy, trust, and respect. And then that empowers you to be in a position to enter into agreements that can get to better outcomes that are more equitable, more just, and create different outcomes that are better for the environment, for people, and also protect business. That's what we did on the Klamath. There's another point too, is that we can still, have business and be profitable. Through the Klamath Dam Removal Project, we injected $515 million into the economy. One of the world's largest construction corporations, Kiewit, did the deconstruction, and they used similar techniques, engineerings, yellow iron equipment to remove dams as they do to build dams. There is a model, and the Klamath is it, of how we can create a global restorative, regenerative, nature-based solutions economy. We don't have to continue to just go around and extract and ruin environments. We can instead, flip the narrative and start restoring these environments using very similar trainings and techniques and models as we did to build all of this. There is a fundamental change that has to occur, which is, nature, environment, people have to, indigenous peoples, all people's rights to have a healthy environment have to be respected. We have to put that at the foundation of all of that work and change. But once you do that, the sky's the limit. And that's what we've proved on the Klamath.
Well, congratulations on your legal successes, and it's all chronicled in this terrific book, The Water Remembers. Amy Bowers Cordalis, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Lettuce and Led Zeppelin.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.